We have been covering what Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, had to say through an actual prophet. Through someone whose utterings, whose writings on behalf of Yahweh are infallible. All of Yahweh's prophets predict the future, and all of them do so with absolute accuracy. Chabaouk is no exception. We have been reviewing what Yahweh inspired Chabaouk to say and write, and we had made our way through the second chapter, the 11th verse. Now, I want to be careful with chapter and verse references. I'm providing them just so that somebody can go and verify what I'm sharing with you for themselves. But there are no chapters, there are no verses in Yahweh's prophetic accounts. One statement flows to the next. And the reason that's important is that, well, I'm going to start at the 11th statement here. You ought not ever think that you are acting responsibly if you take a verse out of context and cite it to make a point. The only way anything makes sense is when it is reviewed in the overall context of the discussion. And this notion that you have cited the entirety of a verse, giving you the authorization to use it, independent of the discussion in which it occurred, is the basis of almost all religious deception. That's what Paul did with Chabaouk. He misquoted a portion of one statement found in the what we now call the second chapter of Chabaouk. And he, by taking it out of context and misquoting what Yahweh said, he was able to fool those who were ignorant of the actual prophecy and the discussion into believing that God had said the opposite of what he actually wrote and proclaimed. So we want to be very careful when dealing with Yahweh's testimony. We are now 11 statements into the second chapter of a prophecy that called out Paul by name, that called him the plague of death, that said that he would use circular reasoning, that said that he would come upon the scene at the time that the Moed were being fulfilled, that said that his character would be astonishingly arrogant, saying that he would contradict Yahweh, that his testimony regarding Yahweh would, first of all, would be about God, and that what he would do was undermine the very things that God had said and be in wholesale opposition to God. All of that has been conveyed thus far. And this goes on to say that indeed the rock, as part of the structure of the home, will issue a proclamation, and that which connects from the timber, he will answer and respond. Now, when we're dealing with the first reference to rock in this particular prophecy, and it says that the rock will expose him, then we could be dealing with one of two individuals. Yahusha, which is the physical manifestation of Yahweh, diminished manifestation of Yahweh, because he is the rock of our salvation. He is the rock or cornerstone that was rejected. He is the very foundation of this testimony. So it could be Yahusha. And Yahusha, in his Sermon on the Mount, completely rejected, exposed, and condemned Paul. In fact, he even condemned Paul by name, speaking of lowly and little, which is what Paulos means, and told us that the wolf, the Benjamite, in sheep's clothing would mislead, would prey upon the Israelites, and that this man would pretend to be what he's not for the express purpose of demeaning the Torah. And he says, don't think for a moment that I came to annul or do away with the Torah. And so the rock exposed and condemned Paul before he wrote his first letter. But so did the man that Yosha named Rock. That would be Shimon, who was called Shimon Kephesh, Kephesh meaning the rock. He became known as the rock when he made the statement that you are the Masiyah, which means the work of Yahweh. And Yosha responded, he says, based upon this, I will build my mikra, my called out, my invitations to be called out and meet. The mikra, the very things that he was fulfilling. Pesach, Matzah, Bekorah, Shavuah. And so, from that point, Yosha went to great lengths to inform Shimon Kephesh, known to the world today as Peter, based upon the Greek word for rock, Petros, that he told him all about Paul and that he should stand up to him. And it's interesting to note that Peter, Shimon Kephesh, did this very thing at the Jerusalem summit. He's the one that stood up to Paul and said, no, your claim that all of the Gentiles have been given to you and that you alone have the right message, that's nonsense. It's not true. And everyone in this room is a witness to the fact it's not true. And then Shimon Kephesh, in his letter, specifically renounces Paul's letters, calls them misleading, tells that they're very poorly written. They not only confuse people, but they lead them astray. So, both rocks were engaged in exposing and condemning Paul. Now, in this particular case, there's only one of the two rocks, the rock of our salvation, the human manifestation of Yahweh, Yosha, that is being discussed. Because while Shimon Kephesh, the disciple known to us as Peter, made some contributions. There's two letters that are attributed to him, one of which is written to condemn Pauline doctrine in Paul's letters. And also he is the most likely source of many of the statements found in the book of Mark. Other than that, we really don't have much from Shimon Kephesh. But with Yosha, of course, much of his testimony is preserved for us. And he is the structure of the home. He is the very basis for the protection of the family by enabling the benefits of the covenant through honoring the first four Moed Mikra. So indeed, the rock, this is capital R now, as in the rock of our salvation, as part of the structure of the home, the very foundation of the home, will issue a proclamation. And the most famous, the most well-documented, the most complete, the most popularly witnessed proclamation by Yosha, the very first proclamation that Yosha made, is what's called the Sermon on the Mount, the instruction on the Mount. So he made this very proclamation first and foremost. The first thing he would say, now this was written 666 years before Paul penned his first letter. And Yosha is fulfilling this prophecy as the rock of our salvation, issuing a proclamation against Paul. I mean, that's the basis, really, of the Sermon on the Mount, is to expose and condemn Paul and his notion that the Torah has been annulled and that there's a new covenant disassociated from the Torah. That's the purpose of the Sermon on the Mount, is to warn people about the religion that would emerge from Paul's letters called Christianity. And so he issued that proclamation. He spoke of Paul other times, too. He said, he will come in his own name and you'll accept him, but I come in my Father's name and you reject me. He talks about him as the false apostle in Ephesus. And there's no other candidate other than Paul. he talks about him as the one who would claim to have seen him in the wilderness and saying that he's a liar. Don't follow him. So Yoshe has a lot to say about Paul, all of which is bad. Now, Yoshe, this prophecy is saying that the proclamation from the rock will connect, will make a connection. The Hebrew word kafik speaks of the rafters and the beams that comprise the structure of the home. From the timber, from the carpenter's work, from the tree, from the gallows, from the etz. And so from the upright pole upon which he fulfilled Passover, he's saying that's the connection that's going to help you understand. And that's the connection which answers and responds, Anah. If you want to know for certain that Paul was wrong, all you have to do is focus on what Yoshe did on Passover. Why was he fulfilling Passover as the sacrificial lamb on the upright pole, the timber, unless the Torah was the source of our salvation? Why fulfill Passover unless Passover was valid? The very fact that Yoshe endured Pesach Passover so that we might live affirms the Torah, validates the Torah, and demonstrates conclusively that Paul lied. Paul never speaks of Passover, never speaks of the importance of Passover, Passover being the source of life, of Yoshe being the sacrificial lamb of Passover. Never. And Passover provides the answer. It's the response of Yahweh through Yahusha that Paul was wrong. This is a very insightful presentation that you have to know what happened on that upright timber. And Yahweh is not coy about this. He's very open throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms of speaking of that upright pillar, of the Edon, of the Eth, of that timber that is the very structure that upholds the tabernacle, the tent of the witness, and the sukkah, the tent that provides the home in which Yahweh is inviting us to engage in a relationship with Him. The very foundation of the home, which is the covenant. It's all being laid out for us here. Now, as we know, Shimon Kefesh, the man Yoshe personally named the rock, summoned Shaul, Paul, to Jerusalem, and he issued a proclamation against him. That is exactly how Acts depicts the Jerusalem summit. And Shimon, Peter, acquired the moniker rock when Yoshe in Hebrew told Shimon, "Upon this rock I will build my invitations to be called out and meet." Now, I'm conveying this in Hebrew. Al-Azeth Ibn Bana Mikre. And the reason I'm conveying what he said in Hebrew, not Greek, is because Yoshe never once spoke Greek, ever. He spoke Hebrew. And so when we're looking at what the Greek text says, we need to translate the Greek text into Hebrew and then convey the Hebrew into English. Upon is al in Hebrew. Al is interesting, too, in that it's not just upon, but it's also the name for the title Almighty. So upon the Almighty's is a accurate rendition of all, upon the Almighty's. And then Zayeth is this specific rock, even. I will build, which is Bana in Hebrew. Bana, and by the way, this even rock is the same even that appears in Chabaouk. I will build Bana. And building in Hebrew is very different than the word build in Greek, and that build in Hebrew is based upon the Hebrew concept of son and daughter. And bana, which would be feminine because of the ah ending, is derived from ben and bena, which ben means son, bena means daughter. And it spoke of building the family name, building the home. That's the uniqueness of building a place for sons and daughters, which is a home. The covenant is a place for the sons and daughters of Yahweh. That's the implication of bana that gets lost when we convert the Hebrew bana, based upon bien and bena, to Greek and then to English. So this is building the home. You know, here in this prophecy, it talks about the rock as part of the structure of the home. And here, it's upon this godly rock that I will build bana, that I will create a place for sons and daughters, a home for sons and daughters, based upon my mikre. And he said mikre. The Greek word that is used to translate it, ekklesia, means to call out. Kara, the basis of mikra, mikre being the plural, kara means to call out. It's to read, to recite, to invite, to summon, to call, and to call out, to welcome, and to meet. Those are the connotations of kara. It was turned into the basis, the verb, becomes the basis of the mikre, mikra singular. And the mikre are pisach, this very thing that happened, that's the first, the doorway, that's timber, which makes the connections as part of this proclamation. The mikre are pisach, matzah, unyeasted bread that provides our perfection. Bakudim, which is firstborn children, which is specific about building the home for children, the children of the covenant. And Shavuah, which was the fourth one that has been fulfilled, which is to enrich and to empower Yahweh's covenant children, which continue through the fifth of the seven mikra at Teruah, where we trumpet Yahweh's message, inviting others to participate in his family, warning those who have chosen a religious path that they're headed in the wrong direction. Reconciliations, kapurim, which whereby Yahweh's children, the children of the covenant, the children of Yisrael, are reconciled back into the covenant relationship with Yahweh, leading to sukkah, which is camping out, to establish a tent home where we camp out with Yahweh. That is those are the mikra. And so upon this statement of him being the Messiah, the representative of God himself, upon that rock of Yosha being the rock, he's going to build, establish a home for the family based upon the invitations to call out. So the connection here, as he was headed, by the way, to Jerusalem to become the sacrificial lamb of Passover, of Yosha saying, upon this rock, upon this realization that I am the work of Yahweh, Yahusha, the Messiah, I will build my invitations to be called out and to meet. In other words, I will establish my mikre as a means to enable the promises of the covenant family. Yahusha was providing the very proclamation as the rock, as a means to make the connection to the upright timber, responding to and providing an answer, making a public declaration regarding this condemnation of Paul and of Pauline doctrine, of his letters, the Christian New Testament. We will also find Paul embracing Gnosticism to denounce the Torah, thereby fixating on the flesh. It's one of the things is you, and it's important for you to know that before I share with you this next statement from Yahweh, that Christians like to present Paul as railing against Gnosticism, But the fact is that Pauline doctrine is Gnosticism. It's Paul creates this artificial construct of the spirit being good and the flesh being bad. And Yahweh has no such notion. Yahweh does not say the flesh is bad. Yosha doesn't say specifically the spirit is good because there are bad spirits. Hasatan and his demons are bad spirits. There is a good spirit, but not all spirits are good. In fact, the spirit that possessed Paul was bad. And the flesh isn't inherently bad. In fact, Yahweh calls it good. But it is the Gnostic way. It was Gnosticism is based on the Greek word to know. And it presented in Greek philosophy and in the Greek religion this notion that the flesh was corrupting and that the real world was an evil and ineffective representation of an unseen perfect world out there, and that the spiritual world was perfect and the physical world was flawed. Now, again, God makes no such distinction. This is Gnosticism, which was embraced by Paul. And Paul loved the use of Gnosticism because he could appear philosophical. He could appear enlightened. He could appear religious to the Jewish mindset. And because of the Jewish mindset despising the flesh, and particularly despising circumcision as a mutilation of the flesh, he could demean the Torah while embracing the very values that Greeks held. So it was an extremely effective strategy. Unfortunately, the strategy was also awesomely religious, awesomely invalid, and corrupt. I mean, Gnosticism, which was the philosophy of Socrates and Plato, has been shown to be wrong. They advocated Gnosticism. Gnosticism is invalid. But Paul, nonetheless, endorsed it. So, this is what God has to say. Woe to the one who reestablishes the place of exposed and naked flesh and anguish and blood. And he forms a populated institution promoting that which is righteous or unrighteous, invalid, and harmful. So woe to the one who reestablishes the place of exposed flesh and anguish in blood. And he forms a populated institution promoting that which is in righteous, unrighteous, invalid, and harmful. Oi is the Hebrew word for this is a strong warning. Woe. In other words, you don't want God saying woe to you. And he does if you're an American. He specifically condemns America beginning with woe in the 18th chapter of Yahshua Isaiah. Now, this is the one who reestablishes Bana, the one who builds a family, erects a construct. So, talking about Paul creating establishing a family. Paul establishing a covenant family, a construct, his new covenant. So, woe to the one that reestablishes Bana, who builds a family, who constructs a home, who establishes something in the place of what God has established. And he's this particular one who is getting the warning is placing their building, their family, their covenant in place of the exposed naked flesh and anguish. It's here in Hebrew. It's the city where terror is exposed from Ur to incite and to strip by blinding and rendering the chaff naked and laying the skin bare in blood, Adam, through death, to destroy by making deaf and dumb. And he forms, Humes proposes and prepares, establishes and supports a populated institution promoting that which is unrighteous, invalid, and harmful. Paul's argument against the Torah was circumcision. And he called circumcision of the flesh. And he went to war against circumcision. Now, if you're not circumcised as a male, you cannot be part of Yahweh's covenant family. And you cannot participate in Passover, which means you cannot become immortal. You can't be saved. You can't engage in a relationship with God. And yet, it was this anguish associated with naked flesh that Paul drew his battle lines, all in harmony with Gnostic philosophy. And he formed the most popular institution in human history, promoting that which is unrighteous, invalid, and harmful, a law, that which is wicked and evil, damaging others through perversity. Yes, Scott?
I have a quick question. As far as the circumcision goes, I was circumcised as a baby. My dad, you know, he's Lutheran, Catholic, whatever. Is it super uncommon for people to be uncircumcised? Because everybody, like most of my friends, are all circumcised and they don't believe any of that, and their parents are all Catholic. Yeah. Are Catholics really known?
No. The reason for circumcision was a preference that a health related preference that became very popular in the West. And so I don't know what the percentage are of Westerners that were circumcised, and the percentage is decreasing now. But really, no one other than Jews did it for the purpose of being part of the covenant. And so it was done. It was common when our sons were born. We had both of them circumcised, just as I was circumcised shortly after birth. And it was just the common, normal practice that it was done. And it was primarily done for health-related reasons. It was not done for any other reason. And, the fact of the matter is, since God doesn't say it has to be done in this particular way by this kind of person, for this particular reason, it doesn't even say how much. It counts. So
I was just saying that I feel pretty lucky that I was, my dad.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's a several thousand dollar operation. It's not a serious operation. The most serious part of it, you do have to be put under because of the cutting, but. Many people that I know have had it as done as an adult to participate in the covenant. It is a requirement for us. You know, the purpose of circumcision was really to establish this idea that when we choose to be part of Yahweh's family, we are separated from the rest of humanity. We're choosing to be part of God's family, separated unto Him, set apart unto Him and the covenant. And that means set apart from the institutions of man. And since we come into the covenant as a family, the way that men and women come together as one through that part of the anatomy, the male anatomy, to conceive children, it's that part of the anatomy that represents being conceived, being brought into the world as a child, that Yahweh chose to symbolize being cut or separated from that which are the institutions of man and unto Him. So it was a marvelous symbol that God conceived, and one that is just a demonstrative way of saying, I get it. I want to be part of the covenant family. And you look at all of the concepts of karat, to cut. To cut means to establish, to cut means to sever, to divide. And so we're severing relationships to form a relationship with Yahweh. We're dividing ourselves away from the corrupt nature of humanity unto the perfect realm of Yahweh's family. and we're doing so at the part of the human anatomy responsible for conceiving life. And the instruction specifically is for mothers and fathers to see to it that their sons are circumcised on the eighth day. The eighth day is symbolic of eternity, of it always has been. It's the symbol for eternity. And so it, what it is a message to parents that help them and their children remember that the single most important thing in our lives is to come to know Yahweh and to engage in His covenant. And this is a tangible representation of that reality. And it's the parent's responsibility, the single most important responsibility that we'll ever have in life, to inform our children so that they're aware of who Yahweh is and what He's offering and how to participate in His covenant. So for all of those reasons, circumcision is a marvelous sign. And it's the very thing that Paul opposed. It's interesting, too, that in what was a primary Christian culture in Europe and in America, Paul went as far as to say, if you're circumcised, you can't be saved. Paul went on the war path against circumcision, calling it, of the flesh and representative of the failed system of the Torah, and yet most Christians are circumcised. It's kind of an interesting twist on things, is it not? Paul's line in the sand, where he attacks circumcision as being of the flesh and therefore condemns it as evil, that the institution that became popular, that Paul promoted based upon that, is unrighteous, invalid, and harmful, even perverse, according to Yahweh. He then says, since there is a better option, through his prophet, we read, why not look here and pay attention? Ha lo henna. Why not look up and behold? Henna, pay attention. By means of an association with Yahweh, of the conscripts that provide assistance, the Shaba. But instead, the people expend their energy and they grow weary amongst an abundance of worthlessness, and the nations which gather together in more than enough delusions and fantasies which are poured forth, which are unreal and have no benefit, resulting in nothingness, exhausting and destroying them. This is Chabaouk to their king. So the alternative is, rather than being part of the Christian religion, that populated institution that promotes that which is invalid and harmful, Chabaouk is saying, why not look here instead at the prophets, at Yahweh's testimony, at Yahweh, and pay attention. By means of an association with Yahweh, making the connection to Yahweh of the Shaba, the vast array of spiritual implements who are enlisted and arranged in a command and control regimes, serving as effective tools. But instead, he's saying, speaking of that popular institution that became Pauline Christianity, but instead, the people expend their energy and they grow weary amongst an abundance of worthlessness, that they expend their energy in a faith which is worthless. There's no question that Christians have made sacrifices, that they've devoted time and energy and labor to this religion. They expend their energy. They toil at it. However, it's nothing but an abundance of worthlessness, uselessness, that which has no value. And the nations which gather together, the peoples who congregate in these delusions, and there's more than enough of them, it says, they're fantasies which are poured out, which are unreal. They have no benefit, resulting in nothingness. If you embrace a false god, Jesus Christ, if you embrace false testimony, Paul's letters in the Christian New Testament, if you accept a religious explanation, then you are not only clinging to a fantasy, based on delusions, but that these doctrines have no benefit whatsoever and ultimately result in your soul becoming nothing. These are fictitious myths. Christianity is based on the Babylonian religion. It's fictitious myths which are wholly unreliable, empty and vain deceptions, exhausting and destroying its victims. That's the sad thing about the false hope that's associated with religion. Those who cling to it, those who engage in it, those who strive to be part of it, are destroyed. It is physically draining. It ruins the participant, causing them to be slighted, diminished into nothingness. And then, through the prophet, Yahweh reveals, indeed, she will fulfill, edify, and completely satisfy the land. To approach, to actually know, and to become genuinely familiar with Yahweh's manifestation of power, glorious presence, and abundant value, similar to the rain, providing a covering for the sea. Well, here we find a reference to one of the means to come to know Yahweh. Now, we've had the first two already mentioned. The rock of our salvation. If you know who Yahusha is, you know that Paul is a liar, based upon Yahusha's nature and proclamations. And we've already been told to look here, which is towards the written letters, the written scriptural evidence of the prophets whereby Yahweh conveyed his nature. And the third, of course, is the manifestation of Yahweh's maternal nature, the set-apart spirit. And we'll pick up here tomorrow.